I'm Heather Vale, and this is the Odyssey Las Vegas Public Affairs Show. Joining me is Leo Mugardichian, VP of Operations at WestCare. The organization recently broke ground on the Village Women and Children's Campus here in Las Vegas. Leo, thank you so much for being here today.
Well, it's my pleasure. Thank you very, very much.
So what exactly is WestCare?
So WestCare is actually a nonprofit. It's a 501c3 behavioral health and human services organization.
Okay. When was it first founded?
WestCare was founded here. It was a one-time $50,000 grant that the agency received here in Las Vegas in 1973. So we just last October specifically, we celebrated 50 years in this community. WestCare from that point has expanded now to be an international agency. We are in 17 states, 4 U.S. territories, Dominican Republic, and the Republic of Palau.
Wow, that's fantastic. All right, so what types of clients do you serve at WestCare?
Our clients have typically been, for better or worse terms, the have-nots in society. So most of our clients are indigent or are either underserved, underinsured, or uninsured. That's typically the clients that we serve internationally.
Okay. Now, you mentioned behavioral health care, but what kinds of services specifically are available to these clients?
So here in Southern Nevada or even across the globe, we are doing mental health and wellness type of services. There are treatment and rehabilitation services. We serve our criminal justice population, both in the prisons and when they reenter into society. Our president and CEO is an Army veteran. He was an Army medic. So we offer services to veterans. There are some opportunities for housing and transitional living, which is what the Village is. We do some education and prevention in relation to substance use disorder. We do some services that are aligned with human trafficking and domestic violence. And we also have emergency support services, or typically what it's called is crisis intervention services.
Okay. So this new development that just broke ground, the Village Women and Children's Campus, you mentioned it's transitional housing. How many people will it serve?
So the Village, and I'll kind of go back about 10 years, a little more than 10 years ago, there were some discussions within our agency. The truth of the matter is over the course of time, treatment episodes are shortening. And yet, if you're dealing with the populations that we are, that are typically up to 90% of the people that we serve are homeless prior to coming into treatment with us. So you treat an individual or even a family or a mother and her child from a substance use or mental health related standpoint. And then after that treatment episode, if they don't have a secure or a safe place to go to, which is why we have this transitional living, they end up right back in the same place that they started. And many, many times those are unsafe environments. So what this Village has done in our conversations 10 years ago, I can tell you that the need has actually increased. Every year the need has grown for this type of service because every year kind of the treatment episodes have also become shorter. So what we plan on building and what we broke ground for was 84 one, two, and three bedroom apartments for women that are by themselves or even women with their children. And what that helps us to do is specifically a woman that participates, let's just say, in a residential level of treatment. Usually based on that criteria, they aren't just somebody that maybe made one mistake in relation to drugs and alcohol or even, you know, having a mental health issue as well. They've kind of been at this for a little while, so they qualify or meet criteria for a residential level of care. I have to admit that a treatment episode requires a whole lot of focus on just that treatment, meaning a person would have to learn about what triggers them, what caused the use. A lot of times there's trauma that's involved in it, why people tend to self-medicate, or maybe they have a mental health disorder that's been undiagnosed. So that takes a whole heck of a lot of work. Then what happens after is, in many, many cases, what the transitional living is supposed to do for us is give us the opportunity to help mom or help the female start to now work on the social determinants of health, because treatment in itself takes that much focus. Then when we get into the social determinants of health, once they've completed a residential level of care, all the other things that would contribute to a person's success now can be addressed a little bit more. You want to think about a neighborhood and a physical environment as part of the social determinants of health, which means housing, transportation, making sure that you're in a safe place, and then even having the opportunity, if you have children, to have parks and playgrounds around you for the benefit of the child. The other thing we think about when someone leaves residential treatment and goes into a transitional living arena, we want to think about economic stability. So there's employment, there's income, there's that type of support that someone's going to need. There's some workforce development, those type of things. The other one, if you think about it, would be community and social context falls under social determinants of health. And that really, for us, means somebody to be able to successfully socially reintegrate into society and even have some participation in some type of community involvement or community engagement. The other things that go along with social determinants of health is healthcare, but usually by the time we get a female, we've hooked them up with some quality healthcare. And then you think about education. This is not just education for mom, which would be more like completing whatever level of schooling that they may or may not have, or even some vocational training in higher education, but you want to think about the children involved as well. So that would mean literacy and early childhood education. So all of those things are what's going to accompany someone stay in a transitional living facility.
Okay. So the village will serve women with or without children who are experiencing things like homelessness or substance abuse. What about domestic violence survivors who are escaping?
So that's also part of it. It's funny that you mentioned that. I just happened to be looking at some grant opportunities today that specifically deal with victims of human trafficking. So we currently serve some of those ladies as well. A lot of the clients that come to us, besides being homeless or being on the streets, they've been prostituted or they've been forced into prostitution. They're coming from domestic violence situations. So again, you bring them into treatment. It all starts to help them get off the substances and get stable from a behavioral health standpoint, meaning both from substances and mental health. And then at that point, what the village is going to do, it's going to provide a safe and secure environment for them to continue to work on those things. So yes, that is absolutely a population that we have served and that we continue to serve in relation to what we're doing in our Women and Children's Campus.
Nice. Okay. So where exactly is or will the village be located?
So the current Women and Children campus is actually located, I'll call it Northwest, but it's off of Rancho and Duncan Drive, which is in the Rancho Cheyenne area. The address of our current facility is 5659 or 5659 Duncan Drive. The village will be right behind that building or right next to it. If you want to say it on Duncan Drive, there's an empty lot there of 5 acres, and that's where we did the groundbreaking, and that's where we plan on building the units. So here's how this kind of works, and I'll just put this in a nutshell for you. Our current facility is also 5 acres, and that is our current Women and Children's Campus that actually is licensed for 59 treatment beds, which would mean substance abuse or co-occurring disorder beds. We also have 30 transitional beds existing now. And this is where we've kind of had the opportunity to master what transitional living is supposed to look like. So those 30 beds are usually full. We also have a women's warriors or a women's veterans shelter out of those 30 beds. So what this gives us the opportunity to do, as we've seen it work, we know exactly what that's going to look like. When we expand and build these 84 units, if it happened tomorrow, let's just say, then those 30 ladies would be able to move into these 1, 2, and 3 bedroom apartments, whether they have children or not. And each one of those units is going to actually have its own kitchen. So currently, we provide the meals to these women and their children. They will have their own kitchen. So we'll be able to bring in, you know, some individuals that will talk about diet and healthy meals and so on and so forth. And that'll be part of the process of them being able to do that. It also gives us these additional 30 beds. And it's funny, like you just mentioned, you know, domestic violence or even human trafficking. If I'm unable or if WestCare is unable to add some treatment beds to those 59 that we're currently licensed for, we will be able to use these 30 transitional beds maybe just for that purpose of being able to shelter and house and help assist women that have experienced or been trafficked, maybe help them get on their feet as well, whether there is or is not a substance use related disorder.
Wow, that's fantastic. When do you expect construction of the village to be complete?
The bid package is actually going to go out one more time because there was a couple edits in it. We are planning that in late spring this year to begin the project. It'll be built in two phases with an estimated completion of fall of 2025.
Okay. Where did the funding for building the village come from?
Well, I can tell you that it was a once-in-a-lifetime experience, even related to some of the ARPA money that came down from our federal government. We have a development team that has gone out, and the funding has actually come from both private and public entities. I'll be specific because it's public record. We received $5 million from the state of Nevada for this project. We actually had one of our congressmen, Congressman Stephen Horsford, earmark $2.5 million of HUD dollars for this project. Mayor Carolyn Goodman and the city of Las Vegas, of course, they earmarked $2.5 million for this project. And then what we were able to do is leverage the public dollars versus the private and vice versa. So we've received some private dollars from some foundations and even some angel donors that have made the decision to contribute to the project. So far, we've raised around $13 million and we still are estimating, we don't know exactly what this project is going to cost. We're estimating that it's going to be somewhere between $18 and $20 million. So we still have a little more work to do.
Wow. That's amazing, though, where all that funding came from. It's obviously a really great project, and it's going to do a lot of good in our community. So where can people go if they want to find out more information about WestCare or the new The Village Women and Children's Campus?
So the simplest thing to do is to go to www.westcarenevada.com. And it'll start to give you all the information. You got a few places you need to click. If you want to get involved, or if you want to donate, or if you just want to see any other information about it, there is an area that you can click to get involved, and then it'll give you all the other options. That webpage shows our leadership. It shows the services we provide in both Southern and Northern Nevada, and it'll give you all the information you need for anybody that wants to get involved, wants to donate, wants to be a part of this whole entire project, and even if they know somebody that actually needs our help right now, what they need to do to help somebody get into treatment.
All right, awesome. So once again, the website is westcarenevada.com, westcarenevada.com. You can find out more about WestCare, the nonprofit organization, and what they do. You can also find out about the Village Women and Children's Campus that just broke ground and is expected to open in the fall of 2025. If you want to get involved, whether that's volunteering, making a donation, finding out more, you can do all that at the website as well. And if you know someone who needs the services that WestCare offers, you can also find that there. Once again, westcarenevada.com. And we've been speaking with Leo Mugardichian. He's the VP of Operations at WestCare. And Leo, I want to thank you so much for being here and letting us know more about this organization and the amazing things you're doing in our community. So I really appreciate your time. Thank you so much.
Ms. Heather, thank you. Thank you very much for giving me this opportunity. It is very much appreciated. Thank you.
Everyone has a community to lean on. A neighborhood, school, kids' teams, where you worship, work out, or any other place or group where you choose to belong. Communities can provide support when you need it, and even when you don't know you do. Like when it comes to preventing underage drinking and other substance use. You've talked with your kids and shared clear expectations, but you're not with them every minute. Your community members, friends and relatives, teachers and coaches, faith leaders, and other important adults in your kids' lives can be your eyes, ears, and a supportive influence when you're not around, reinforcing your messages with your kids and alerting you to warning signs of underage drinking or other substance use. So talk with your kids about these issues and involve the members of your community to help keep your kids safe. Because when you talk, they hear you. For more information, visit talktheyhearyou.samhsa.gov.
This is the Odyssey Las Vegas Public Affairs Show. I'm Heather Vail, and I'm speaking with Lisa Tomlin Kerr, Senior Director of Development for the Las Vegas Metropolitan Police Department Foundation. They have their 32nd annual LVMPD canine trials coming up at South Point and the 7th annual Hidden Heroes Black and White Gala at the Palms. Lisa, thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you for having me.
So for those who aren't familiar with the organization, what exactly does the Las Vegas Metropolitan Police Department Foundation do?
Yeah, so we're our support for LVMPD, meaning that our pillars are equipment, training and community engagement. So we really support the department, kind of help facilitate some of those events, like maybe back to school backpacks, so that, you know, really Metro is having a positive interaction with the community and helping the community in need. You know, taking that pressure off of back to school. How do I get my kids, you know, backpacks, Christmas, holiday meals? So we're really there to help support the community engagement to bridge the gap between community and law enforcement.
Awesome. Okay. So tell us about the 32nd annual LVMPD canine trials.
Yeah, this is a really exciting event. So one really exciting fact is that the Las Vegas Metropolitan Police Department canine unit is the longest standing canine unit in the United States. So,
wow.
Yeah, that's really exciting to hear. And so with the canine trials, it is a 2-day competition. It starts off on Friday with a welcome reception, and then they go into a 2-day competition. We have outside agencies. In fact, we have 27 agencies that are participating from California, Utah, Arizona. And what they do is they are testing the handlers and the canines on, you know, agility, narcotics. They hide narcotics in a car and they have to sniff it out and find it. Bomb detections, those type of things. And it's a 2-day competition of kind of seeing what these canines can do. But Sunday is open to the public. And it's going to be on March 24th at South Point. And it's a free event. And they get to see these canines in action, you know, agility and commands when they want them to stop and go a different direction. How do they know that they're going after a bad guy, not the civilian next to them?
Awesome. So how do they determine the winning dog? Is it like the Olympics where they get scored by judges?
They do. They do. We have judges that are coming, you know, from Florida and California. So we have about 10 judges and they are with the canines and they go through the 2-day competition. And they're scored. I mean, you have where you can have maybe top agency, you need at least 3 handlers and their canines entered into the event. It's definitely competitive. And the handlers and the agencies look forward to this event every year. It's actually one of the largest canine trials out there.
That's fantastic. Now, what are some of the skills that police dogs have that people might not be aware of?
Yeah, so I think that one of the things is that some of our dogs, there's like 3 or 4 dogs that can detect, you know, human remains. Not all dogs can do that. We also, some dogs are explosive dogs, and that's all they do is detect explosives. So, you know, it's really about the type of dog can only do a certain type of, you know, narcotics and explosives. Maybe those are dogs are a little different than from the agility dogs and the commands that are out there in patrol.
Okay. And are they mostly German Shepherd? Because that's what I picture when I think of a canine unit dog.
They are. A lot of them are German Shepherd, but I know that some of the other canines are different types of breeds, but for the most part, they are Shepherds.
Okay, so that's taking place. It's open to the public on Sunday, March 24th at South Point Arena. Doors at 8, opening ceremony at 9. And then after that, a few weeks later, you have the 7th annual Hidden Heroes Black and White Gala. What's that all about?
Yeah, so this started with one of our board members, Nami, over at the Gratitude Project. So, you know, right after 1 October, you know, the heroism of our first responders and LVMPD, Nami really said, how can we pay tribute to different departments in Metro that are normally not seen? So everyone loves the canines. Everyone knows the canines. Everyone knows SWAT, but not everyone knows other areas in the department, and we wanted to make sure that we're saying thank you and that we're honoring these different departments at Hidden Heroes. So it's a different unit each year.
Okay, so who is the gala honoring as a Hidden Hero this year?
So this year, it's going to be Air Support and Search and Rescue section. So, you know, the funny thing is that when I came on to the foundation last year, we were honoring the special planning section. Mm-hmm. Didn't know we had one, you know, didn't know that there was a special section for that. But the search and rescue is really amazing because they also have five different teams. It could be the dive team. It can be hiking, climbing. It just depends on the different elements that we have here in our state that we may need help for search and rescue because, you know, we have the lake, you know, we have Red Rock. So we need to make sure that we have trained people in those particular elements. A dive team may not have the right skills to go up and search for somebody in Red Rock, you know. So it's really interesting to dive into those sections and really notice them on what they're doing and the fact that they are working with, you know, a team of 28. It's really impressive on what they're doing in the community.
Awesome. So when and where is the Hidden Heroes Black and White Gala taking place?
So it's going to be on Friday, April 12th at the Palms Casino and Resort. And it's going to be at from 5:30 to 9. It really is a fun event. It's an event of just really getting to mingle and talk to that unit. I think that's what a lot of our attendees, our sponsors enjoy doing because sometimes they're rock stars. They don't get to talk to someone who is working in air support and search and rescue to see what their day in, day out looks like, you know, versus when I go to work. So it really is an experience to be able to see. We get to see live video of some of their rescues. We're going to be able to, you know, talk about what type of rescues that they've done in the past. So it's up for a great event.
Awesome. Okay. So how can listeners find out more about the LVMPD Foundation in general, the 32nd annual LVMPD Canine Trials, or get tickets to the 7th annual Hidden Heroes Black and White Gala?
Yeah, so if you go to our website, lvmpdfoundation.org, you can go on and find information about our events and how they can support Metro through the foundation. These events are fundraisers. So for the canine trials, that fundraising, even though it's a free event, the community can still support. We sell canine merchandise there. We come out with new merchandise every year. So that's when we come out the canine. You can buy a canine hoodie and t-shirts and hats. We have raffle prizes. So the community can support in that manner. And the money that we raise at the canine trials go towards retired canine dogs so that we take care of them when they retire. We make sure, you know, their medical bills and stuff like that is paid for. They served our community. We want to make sure that they're provided for when they're retired.
That's awesome. Okay. So once again, the website, lvmpdfoundation.org, stands for Las Vegas Metropolitan Police Department Foundation, lvmpdfoundation.org. You can find out more about the 32nd annual Las Vegas Metropolitan Police Department Canine Trials, which are happening on Sunday, March 24th, doors at 8 a.m., opening ceremony at 9 a.m., and that's happening at South Point Arena. General admission is free, but as Lisa mentioned, it's a fundraiser and there are things you can buy, merchandise, you can make donations. And then the LVMPD Foundation and the Gratitude Project together are hosting the 7th annual Hidden Heroes Black and White Gala. They're honoring the LVMPD Air Support Search and Rescue section this year. And that is happening Friday, April 12th, starting at 5:30 p.m. at the Chaos Nightclub Palms Casino Resort. So once again, all of that information is at lvmpdfoundation.org. And we've been speaking with Lisa Tomlin-Kerr. She's the Senior Director of Development for the Las Vegas Metropolitan Police Department Foundation. And Lisa, I want to thank you so much for being here and letting us know more about what the foundation does to support both the police and the community and all these amazing events. It seems like you've constantly got events going on, so I'm glad you're here sharing some of them with us. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
This is McGruff the Crime Dog, and I need you to help me take a bite out of crime. Counterfeit products are popping up everywhere. Fake sneakers, fake cosmetics, and even fake pills. Crooks are selling counterfeit versions of just about everything. Last year, billions of dollars worth of counterfeit products were sold in the U.S. Sure, it may seem like saving a few bucks on the things you want isn't a big deal, but counterfeits are usually made in unsafe conditions, potentially using hazardous and even lethal ingredients that could harm you and others. And the money you've paid, it goes right into the hands of criminals and may support child labor, drugs, and even gangs. Smells like big crime to me. So if you still think buying fake products is harmless, think again. And remember, if you don't know where the products came from, how could you know where the money goes? You're smart. Buy smart. Go for real. Learn more at McGruffPSA.org. This message is brought to you by the United States Patent and Trademark Office and the National Crime Prevention Council.
I'm Heather Vail, and this is the Odyssey Las Vegas Public Affairs Show. Joining me is Dr. Claudio Sandoval, Senior Director of Scientific and Medical Affairs at Octapharma, as well as patient educator Tony Besa. March is Bleeding Disorders Awareness Month, and 3 million Americans suffer from a bleeding disorder. Many of them depend on the kindness of strangers for life-saving treatments like plasma donation, and Tony's son Andrew is one of them. Thank you both for being here today.
You're welcome. Thank you for having us.
Tony, first of all, could you tell us about Andrew's disease and the journey that led to his diagnosis?
Sure. Andrew, at age 3, was diagnosed with VWD after we were accused of child abuse. And after being accused, we went to our pediatrician who did a number of tests to no avail. And then he finally had one of his new doctors in his practice. He was talking to her about it, and she asked him if he ran the VWD test, and we did, and that's when we found out he had von Willebrand's disease, type 2A severe. And it's been an ongoing process, and right now he's living life to the fullest thanks to plasma donations.
Wow, that's awesome. Dr. Sandoval, what exactly is VWD, and how is plasma used to treat it?
Sure. So von Willebrand's disease is the so-called most common benign bleeding disorder. There are different types of von Willebrand's disease. There are types where there is just not enough of the von Willebrand factor protein. There are other types, like Tony's son, where the von Willebrand protein is present, but it doesn't function normally. And one of the treatments for von Willebrand's disease is a medication that is derived from human plasma. So plasma is collected, and these proteins are then taken from the plasma, and then we make these medications. So in essence, persons who donate plasma are saving someone's life every time they donate plasma.
Okay. Now, how does von Willebrand's disease compare to another bleeding disorder that people might be more familiar with, like hemophilia?
Even though they're both bleeding disorders, they're two different types of bleeding disorders. The only thing they have in common is that factor VIII is involved with both of them. But one should not confuse hemophilia A, which is factor VIII deficiency, with von Willebrand's disease. They're two completely disorders. They're treated differently. The bleeding symptoms are different. Two completely different bleeding disorders.
Okay. Tony, what are plasma treatments like for Andrew?
When Andrew gets his factor, the plasma is processed, and then he gets it back in a crystal form, which is then we take a dilution solution, add it to it to bring it back to a liquid form. And then that's when he uses the factor and uses it intravenously, and it takes about 15, 20 minutes to do one factoring. And he does that twice a week. And his life is, like I said, it's changed it for the better.
Is plasma the only treatment he gets, or is there medication as well?
There are medications that he can have, but none of them work for him. He does take tranexamic acid for nosebleeds and stuff like that, or if he's having any dental procedures. But basically, the plasma-driven is the only thing that will work for him.
Wow. How old is Andrew?
He is now 22.
Okay. So is this a lifelong treatment that he needs to go through?
Yes, it is. He will always be treated for this for the rest of his life.
Wow. So, Dr. Sandoval, if someone wants to donate plasma to help someone like Andrew, what's the process for doing that?
Sure. So they can come into an Octapharma Plasma Center, and they can make an appointment to be seen. If it's their first time, it'll take a little bit longer because they'll need to go through a medical exam. The person is then taken to a seat. He has an intravenous line put in. And then they are hooked up to a machine that collects their blood, spins off the plasma, returns the blood cells, and then that process, that cycle, is repeated about 6 to 7 times. So the plasma is then collected and sent to a processing center. And again, I know we're harping on this, but every single time a person donates plasma, he is saving, or she is saving, someone's life.
Okay, so when someone goes to a standard blood donation drive, that's not the same thing as donating plasma?
That is correct. That a standard blood donation, they just donate the blood. It takes about 15 minutes and then off they go. They too are saving people's lives, but it's a different process than donating plasma. Because what we need to do when we donate plasma is that when we collect the blood, we have to spin off the plasma from the blood and then return the blood cells back to the patient.
Okay. And is there an Octapharma Plasma Donation Center in Las Vegas?
There are two. I just been told there are two donation centers in Las Vegas. So if one is busy, go to the other one.
Okay, awesome. Tony, now what would you say to someone who might be interested in helping out by donating plasma, but maybe they're on the fence and not really sure?
I would recommend that they do it. Like Dr. Sandoval said, they are saving someone's life. I am grateful for everyone that has been donating for my son. And it's very important. They have to realize not only are they doing something great, but they're also saving someone's life. And I would recommend to everybody, please, please donate plasma.
Yeah. Okay. Dr. Sandoval, what is the website where people can go for more information or to find the local plasma donation centers that are closest to them?
So they can go to octapharmaplasma.com and they can get information on donating plasma, what the process is like, where to find a center, how to make an appointment, and knowing that today, if they donate plasma, they save the life.
Okay, perfect. OctapharmaPlasma.com, once again, is the website. That's OctapharmaPlasma.com, OctapharmaPlasma.com. You can find the plasma donation center nearest to you. There's two of them here in Las Vegas. And you can also find out more information about plasma donation in general, what it involves, and how you could be saving a life by donating plasma. And we've been speaking today with Dr. Claudio Sandoval. He's the Senior Director of Scientific and Medical Affairs at Octapharma. And Tony Besa is the parent of Andrew, who is receiving plasma treatment and also patient educator with Octapharma. So I want to thank you both so much for being here. Tony, for sharing your story about Andrew's journey, and Dr. Sandoval for giving us more information about plasma donation. Once again, that website, octapharmaplasma.com. And thank you both so much for your time.
Thank you very much for having us.
Thank you.
My name is Juanita Segura, and I was diagnosed in November of 2014 with non-small cell lung cancer. The first time I heard about biomarker testing was actually my husband. He just started researching about lung cancer.
And I found out about biomarker testing, and I'm like, why not? Let's try it.
I'm Dr. Jorge Gomez, thoracic medical oncologist at the Mount Sinai Hospital. Comprehensive biomarker testing is looking for either substances in the blood or mutations in some of the genes of the cancer cells that can help us identify special types of lung cancer that can be treated with what we call targeted therapies.
Letting my children know brought all of us a sense of hope. To give them hope that mom is going to be around to see you grow up. And I promised them that.
Ask your doctor about how comprehensive biomarker testing before treatment may help you and your doctor decide on the best treatment for you. Visit noonemissed.org for more.
A public service message from Longevity Foundation.
From Odyssey, in partnership with the American Foundation for Suicide Prevention, this is I'm Listening, Talk Away the Dark, a limited series. Today, David Glover hosts our intimate conversation on Straight Talk with Men regarding their thoughts, emotions, and potential suicidal ideation. He is joined by the Vice President of Health Equity and Engagement for the American Foundation for Suicide Prevention, Victor Armstrong, and Steve Seipel, a longtime AFSP volunteer, advocate, and who has had his own personal experiences with suicide, suicidal ideation, grief, and loss. And now, here's David Glover.
The reason I'm actually here is that in 2002, my brother Keith ended his own life. And standing literally, this is very dramatic, but standing literally at my dad's casket in March of 2002, my brother talked about taking his own life. We all know who are involved in this, who have been through this, that there's some people who never talk about it. And there's some people who talk about it a lot. So since then, that's been sort of my mission, is to do whatever I could to help with suicide prevention. My first guest is Vic Armstrong. He's an AFSP expert. He was born and raised the son of a pastor in North Carolina. As such, he developed an appreciation for the challenges experienced by historically marginalized communities. Steve Seipel is also with me, and Steve has an amazing story. Suicide and suicide prevention have touched at least three generations of his family. Steve, let's start with you. Please tell us your story.
I lost my father in 2001 to suicide. He was 53 at the time. After a couple of years of working through that complicated grief, I actually had found the Out of the Darkness Community Walk, the first season of those with the American Foundation for Suicide Prevention. Another mother of one of our kids had reached out to my wife via email looking for volunteers to help organize this walk. That mom had no idea that I had lost my father to suicide. So it was a very direct answer to prayer that I had during that season to do something positive with my tragedy and help other people through my experience. And it's been, gosh, what is it, 2024? It's been 20 plus years that I've been involved with AFSP.
You eventually had your own struggles with mental health and with suicidal ideations. Can you tell the audience about that?
I did. About 5 years ago, I was in between jobs, as they say. I was really struggling towards the end of the calendar year with what my future held and really trying to hold our finances together. And I had a pretty acute suicidal ideation one day. And then the next week, I had a friend, I was at a meeting and was with another friend of mine who's a volunteer for AFSP. We left that meeting outside of the building. My friend turned to me and noticed that there was something different about me and came straight out and asked if I'd been thinking about suicide.
Which is really what we're talking about today. During this episode of Talk Away the Dark, we're focusing on men and struggles with mental health and suicide. What was it about thinking about not being here anymore that seemed like a relief to you?
There was an acute pain. You know, there was a feeling of doom and hopelessness that I had that I couldn't shake. And I had had that before, but it's a spectrum, right? It was at a point where I had actually gotten to the point where I had brought the suicide prevention text number up on my phone and started a message, but didn't send it. So it was that close. I have found also that, at least for me personally, you know, that the acuteness of that moment, it usually lasts about 10 or 15 minutes. If I can get through 15 minutes and be safe, then it usually will leave me. Now, that may not be the case for everybody, but I think there's a lot to that. The biggest risk factor for our demographic is loneliness. And if we're alone, that's the greatest risk of suicide, I think.
I relate to that. My style of suicidal ideation is wishing there was a wizard who could just push a reset button so that I wouldn't be blamed for anything, so that no one would be mad at me, so there'd be no guilt. But if I could just push that reset like on a video game and start over again, or just kind of go into a soft oblivion, that was what seemed like a release to me. Steve, when your friend asked you so bluntly, are you thinking about killing yourself? What did that do? Was it like the proverbial slap in the face?
It was more like a waterfall, a waterfall of emotions. I teared up. I admitted I had. I thanked her immediately. That was the button that needed to be pressed for me to one, you know, increase the frequency of my therapist visits, two, admit to my wife what I had been feeling. I hadn't even admitted it to my closest love. It was like a permission to talk about it.
Vic, does a lot of this hit in tune with you and your background and your pursuits?
Yes, I'm sitting here listening to both of you. I think so much of what you're sharing both aligns with a lot of what we know about suicide, and also in the way that you talk about some of your experiences and the way that you deal with it. There are also some things that you're doing that I think are just are naturally the way that survival instinct sometimes can kick in. As I'm listening to you, Dave, even as you were talking about your reset, oftentimes what we do find, and this also ties in to Steve's story about how the acuteness lasts from 10 to 15 minutes. Oftentimes, if we can get past that 10 to 15 minutes, if we can get past that temporary acuity, we can hit that reset. And it doesn't mean that your suicidal thinking completely goes away, but that moment when you are in that darkest place to where you are planning to end your life, if you can get past that moment, oftentimes you can find your ability to reset. And what also happens then is, even as you're thinking about that, if you had a magic wand, if you had a wizard and you didn't have to do this, didn't have to be here, what also happens sometimes is when we talk about it, even as Steve's friend asked him what was going on with him, sometimes we talk about it, we ask the question, and then we listen, and we get people an opportunity to talk about what's going on with them. Oftentimes people find a way to talk themselves through that 10 to 15 minutes of acuity, ever how long it lasts. So even in that time when you're thinking about, well, what if I didn't have to do this? What if I didn't have to be here anymore? What it also allows you to do is think about, how did I get to this point where suicide became the answer? And if you can start to think about that, sometimes we can get ourselves through that moment. But also when you're dealing with someone who is in that dark place where they're really thinking about suicidality, sometimes asking them that question, are you thinking about killing yourself? And then how did this become an option? How did you get to the mm-hmm. point where suicide was the answer for you? When they start to talk through it, you often will find out that it's not that one event, that one trigger that we often think is the thing that bring someone to that point of suicidality. It's often a combination of things. I often tell people the way I talk about suicide is that we tend to talk about it as like suicide itself is a disease. Suicide itself is not a disease. It is the worst possible outcome mm-hmm. of a combination of a lot of very complex things, often including mental health challenges. But that also means that if it's a combination of those things, there are also opportunities to intervene if we have the right access, the right resources at the right time. And sometimes that intervention can be that one person who says to you, are you thinking about suicide? And asks you the question, talk to me about this. Tell me what you're feeling. Tell me how you got to this point. And then that gives you that ability to reset.
Yeah, Vic and Steve, what you're saying makes me think about, we all have that voice in our head. And the meanest guy I know is the voice in my head. He does not like me. And we all know that when you talk to a friend and your friend has these insurmountable problems, you can solve their problems pretty easily. You can say, look, buddy, you told me five things. We can work through all five of these things. When it's you, it's so much more difficult. Let's talk about, as men, why do you think this, and how do you think this affects us in particular? This waterfall effect of stress and problems, and I just can't get out from under this.
We're wired to provide and to solve problems and to produce, you know, as men, I think. And it's just natural to be, you know, mentally working on something. Unfortunately, you know, as you said, some of us will get to where we're trying to solve a lot of problems that, you know, either don't exist and are just perceived, or we're overstating the severity of those problems.
Yeah, and I think for me, I think the good and the bad is that the voice in my head loves me a whole lot. The voice in my head thinks I'm just thinks I'm the coolest person in the world sometimes, which also means that voice thinks that I can overcome anything. Mm-hmm. That voice in my head thinks that I should be able to power through anything. And I think as men, we're socialized to really believe that strength is in being able to do it by yourself. That it's a sign of weakness when you have to ask for help, or it's a sign of weakness when you have to admit that you feel vulnerable. I used to work for several years counseling men who were court ordered for domestic violence. And even in those situations, I often found that men didn't have the language to talk about emotions. Mm. And that impacts our mental well-being, because when we can't identify that what we're really feeling is loneliness, or what we're really feeling is fear, we tend to attach other emotions to it that we can identify with. And sometimes that's either anger, or sometimes it's failure. We see ourselves as failures because we can't power through something. Yeah. And so I tell men all the time, I tell couples all the time, that one of the best things that you can do for the man in your life, the men in your life, is create safe space for them to be vulnerable, to talk about when they're feeling like they're overwhelmed, or when there are things that they feel like they can't deal with. As opposed to feeling like I can't show vulnerability. I've got to be able to show strength.
And what I'd like to do, in case I have failed to ask some of the right questions, or there are some roads we didn't go down, let's just kind of each take a turn. And, you know, final thoughts or some things that we've learned today. I'll lead it off. I will always remember, I'll call it the 15-minute rule, Steve, that you brought up, and Vic, that you confirmed. Get through the 15 minutes, and if you start feeling like you can't, pick up the phone, dial 988, call your best friend if you think you're not going to make it through that 15 minutes. Steve, how about you? Final thoughts.
It took everything. When I was in my dark place, it took everything. Mental health therapy, it took medication, it took exercise, it took a healthy community of men socially, it took my faith. It takes so many things to just, you know, just use every resource and think about every aspect of life in terms of keeping your mental health in check.
Vic.
If you are concerned about someone that you think may be thinking of suicide, don't be afraid to ask them the question clearly, concisely, confidently, are you thinking about suicide? And you may not be able to move someone from their suicidal thoughts in one conversation, but you can absolutely save a life in one conversation. Mm-hmm. If you can get that person just to pause and reset. And to anyone out there who's listening, just know that if you're struggling, your pain matters, your life matters. And if you are considering suicide, or if you're just experiencing some kind of mental health challenges, get help. And you can always dial 988 and be connected to a trained counselor who can connect you with the help, with the services, with the support that you need when you need it most.
You guys have been listening to Talk Away the Dark, in Odyssey production in association with American Foundation for Suicide Prevention. Again, if anyone is struggling and it is emergent, pick up the phone. If it's something that you're not in your 15-minute window, go to afsp.org. Steve, can't thank you guys enough. I've learned a great deal. It's meant a lot to me, and I hope to talk to you in the future. Thank you so much.
To find out more about Talk Away the Dark, along with many more resources from the American Foundation for Suicide Prevention, please visit afsp.org. If you or someone you know is in crisis, please call or text 988. This is the National Suicide and Crisis Lifeline. Someone is there to help you right now. I'm Listening is the mental health pillar of Odyssey in this radio station. Please remember, talk has the power to save lives. For the full show and more stories like this one, download the I'm Listening podcast on the Odyssey app or visit imlistening.org.
Today, 1 in 5 Americans experience emotional and mental health challenges, but many of us don't know how to ask for help.
At the American Psychiatric Association Foundation, we work every day to eliminate stigma and advance mental health. Visit mentallyhealthynation.org to learn more.
The changing of seasons can affect how you feel. 1 in 5 people experience some form of depression, no matter the time of year.
At the American Psychiatric Association Foundation, our vision is to build a mentally healthy nation for all. Visit mentallyhealthynation.org to learn more.
I'm Heather Vail with the Odyssey Las Vegas Public Affairs Show, and this is your community events calendar for nonprofit initiatives and charity events around the Valley. March is National Colorectal Cancer Awareness Month, and the Colorectal Cancer Alliance is urging you to get screened with new younger age recommendations. Find out more or take the screening quiz at getscreened.org. That's getscreened.org. Monday's Dark with Mark Chinook is a bi-monthly musical fundraising party at The Space, with each event raising $10,000 for a specific charity in 90 minutes. Upcoming shows include this Monday, March 18th at 8 p.m. benefiting the Collaboration Center, and Monday, April 1st at 8 p.m. benefiting Nevada Fertility Advocates. Get tickets or find out more details at mondaysdark.com. That's mondaysdark.com. The Junior League of Las Vegas is hosting the Peace Love Las Vegas 5K charity race next Saturday, March 23rd at 9 a.m. at Floyd Lamb Park. Find out more or register to participate at jllv.org/5K. That stands for Junior League Las Vegas, jllv.org/5K. The Las Vegas Metropolitan Police Department Foundation is hosting the 32nd annual LVMPD Canine Trials next Sunday, March 24th, with doors at 8 a.m. and opening ceremony at 9 a.m. at South Point Arena. General admission is free, and canine teams from law enforcement, military, and casino properties will compete in a variety of events, including agility and handler protection. Find out more or register for free at lvmpdfoundation.org/canine trials. That's lvmpdfoundation.org/canine trials. The Nevada Shakespeare Festival is bringing a variety of the Bard's notable works to Las Vegas with three productions this season. The main stage production of Titus Andronicus runs for two weekends, March 28th to 30th and April 3rd to 6th, with 7:30 p.m. performances at Cornerstone Park, 1600 Wigwam Parkway. And the April 3rd performance will be Pay What You Can. The free Shakespeare in the Park tour will feature Macbeth and take place in April and May at various locations around the Valley, including Saturday, April 13th in Solista Park at Inspirada at 6 p.m., Thursday, April 25th in Heritage Park Senior Center at 1:30 p.m., and Saturday, May 4th at the Silver Spring Rec Center at 6 p.m. And Julius Caesar will be presented on May 9th to 11th at Las Vegas Academy of the Arts. All the performances include modern and unexpected elements. You can find out more or get your tickets at NevadaShakespeareFestival.com. That's NevadaShakespeareFestival.com. The Nevada chapter of the National Bleeding Disorders Foundation is holding their 9th annual Winter Wine Fest on Friday, April 5th from 6 to 8 p.m. with VIP reception at 5 p.m. at the Las Vegas Events Center downtown, 1201 Las Vegas Boulevard, just south of Charleston. Grab a glass of red while supporting those with bleeding disorders. Find out the details or get tickets at hfnv.org. That stands for Hemophilia Foundation Nevada, hfnv.org. The 6th annual Walk for Friendship Las Vegas Fundraiser Walk and Community Carnival is happening Sunday, April 7th, with check-in at 10 a.m., walk at 11 a.m., and carnival at noon at Las Vegas Sports Park, 1400 North Rampart. Support the Friendship Circle's efforts to provide social and recreational opportunities for children and young adults with disabilities. Find out more or register at walkforfriendshiplv.com. That's the number four, walkforfriendshiplv.com. The Las Vegas Metropolitan Police Department Foundation and the Gratitude Project are hosting the 7th annual Hidden Heroes Black and White Gala, honoring the LVMPD Air Support Search and Rescue Section on Friday, April 12th at 5:30 p.m. at Chaos Nightclub at Palms Casino Resort. Find out more info or get your tickets at lvmpdfoundation.org/hidden-heroes. That's lvmpdfoundation.org/hidden-heroes. Miracle Flights is hosting the second annual Soaree fundraising event on Friday, April 12th from 6 to 10 p.m. at Thrive Aviation Private Jet Hangar. This event supports the organization's mission of helping children who need to travel for life-changing medical care. Find out more or get your tickets at miracleflights.org. That's miracleflights.org. Habitat for Humanity Las Vegas is hosting their fourth annual Putt for Homes golf tournament on Monday, April 22nd with an 8 a.m. shotgun start at the Red Rock Country Club Mountain Course. Find out more or register to play at lasvegashabitat.org. That's lasvegashabitat.org. Make-A-Wish Southern Nevada is holding their 22nd annual Walk for Wishes fundraising event on World Wish Day, Saturday, April 27th, with 8 a.m. registration and the walk and run starting at 8:30 a.m. at Town Square. Make-A-Wish chapters and affiliates across the globe come together each year to celebrate World Wish Day, the anniversary of the wish that inspired the founding of Make-A-Wish back in 1980. You can join in the celebration of more than 550,000 wishes that have already been granted while raising funds for future wishes. Sign up or find out more information at wish.org/snv/walk. That's wish.org/snv/walk. And Aid for AIDS of Nevada, or AFAN, is hosting the 34th annual AIDS Walk Las Vegas on Sunday, April 28th at 9 a.m. at Las Vegas Ballpark, 1650 South Pavilion Center Drive. This year, AFAN celebrates 40 years of providing HIV/AIDS services to the community, and the walk is in partnership with Clark County's Love, Live, Undetectable Equals Untransmittable campaign. Penn and Teller return as Grand Marshals for the 23rd consecutive year, and dogs are welcome with a signed pet waiver. Register for the event or find out more at afanlv.org. That stands for Aid for AIDS of Nevada, afanlv.org.